afternoon, and welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pape Machinery is located up at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake City, just off I-5. Go up and see them if you need a tractor, you need an implement, you need your tractor fixed, need parts, they do it all up there. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at papemachinery.com. So what's new and exciting?
Not a great question for me today.
No.
Let's see. Tell us a little bit about our guest, Bill.
Our guest today is Dr. Peter Pry. And our Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, and we're going to talk about Taiwan and what's happening over there. China's making a move, and it's going to be interesting to see what happens, because I'm not sure we're really in a position to do much about anything over there right now, but we're going to find out. Dr. Pry, how are you doing today?
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm talking to you from a beach on Boca Raton, pavilion overlooking beautiful Boca Raton, Florida, watching people play football out there in the sand.
Oh, man, I'm jealous.
Well, you know, that's my last day here, that I have to head back to Virginia.
Well, thanks for taking time to be on the radio today. That must have been a tough choice.
Oh, not at all. I always love to listen to the incredible humor of Aaron Ryan and yourself.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
You know, and besides, I'll probably be talking to you a lot from here, because I bought a home down in this area. I had one a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
But now that Florida is one of the last free states, you know, I want you to be here. Almost nobody wears masks. It's almost like it was before COVID.
Yeah.
Almost like real life.
Yeah, Florida's kind of getting it figured out. I wish the rest of the country would move on as well, but soon enough.
Your home state of Virginia's gone kind of crazy.
Yes, it is. And I'm going to keep my Virginia home, but, and probably go back and forth, but I'm going to switch my citizenship to being a Floridian, which is voting with my feet like everybody else in the country.
There you go.
Enjoying the land of the free down here. The topic today is Taiwan, and it's beyond Taiwan. It's also the Cuban Missile Crisis. You know, because we're only a few days away. October 16th is usually given as the anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. It'll be the 59th anniversary, almost 60 years since the Cuban Missile Crisis happened, and which many people regard as the closest we ever came to a nuclear war. Although that isn't true, there was at least one incident that was closer in 1995, but that can be the topic for. In fact, there were a couple of incidents that were probably closer, but that can be the topic for another time. The Cuban Missile Crisis always looms large, though, because it favors the Democratic Party. You know, the myth of JFK backing down the Russians, you know, is one of their favorite, is one of the few areas wherein they are interested in talking about nuclear crises and nuclear matters, because it's a big plus up for the Democrat Party, and Kennedy does deserve credit for what happened in Cuba, not only because of his leap.
Uh-oh.
I think a wave got him.
There's a lot of quietness all at once.
I hear the beach. We're going to have to try to make that connection again.
So much for the land of the free, huh?
Yeah.
Apparently the land of the free has been silenced. Momentarily.
I don't know. When he talks about the Cuban Missile Crisis, I know there's a lot of folks out there that probably aren't real familiar with that, but it is part of our history, and it is probably the closest we've come to a nuclear exchange. As a lot of folks know, Russia backed the Castro regime and installed nuclear missiles in Cuba aimed at the United States, which gave them a huge first strike capability. And Kennedy was able to back them down and get them to pull those missiles out of Cuba. I think a lot of that was due to the fact that Russia really wasn't in a position to get in a shooting war with the United States at that time. We had them outnumbered with our nuclear capability like 10 to 1 at that time, and they knew it. And plus, Cuba was so far away from Russia, they weren't really in a position to deploy across the ocean like that. So they did back down, and we averted a disaster. And now we're sitting here watching all this happen with Taiwan, and the similarities are kind of spooky. Now we're an ocean away. We're outnumbered tactically by the Chinese. And are we really in a position to do anything if China does decide to hit Taiwan? I mean, it wouldn't be easy for them, but they certainly have.
There you are.
I was doing my best Dr. Pry right there, and I was.
He was channeling your article. We should tell people that's posted on here. The Taiwan nuclear powder keg, a new Cuban missile crisis.
Yep.
And so that's on the page for today, which is October 10th.
Can you hear me all right?
Yep. We got you now.
Okay. Sorry, I cut out there. I don't know. I cannot account for it. Because I could hear you perfectly well.
Oh, it's always fun when that happens, and we're going hello.
Hello.
Yeah, and we won't even say the "Can you hear me now?" thing, because that guy just got way too annoying. It used to be fun, but he ruined it.
So, how'd I do? China is now a looming threat. Where do we stand right now?
Well, let me go back to because what I'm trying to do is talk about lessons learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis that may be applicable to the looming confrontation with China over Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lessons that are applicable and some that may not be. But the bottom line is that we're in big trouble where China is concerned. Because all of the factors that favored us during the Cuban Missile Crisis now favor China when it comes to Taiwan. Except that it favors them in space. They're in an even stronger position than we were during the Cuban Missile Crisis. To my knowledge, I'm really the only one who's tried to draw parallels between the situation with Cuba and the United States and the situation between Taiwan and China. And yet, there are enormous parallels between the two. You know, back in 1962, you know, communist Cuba was too weak to defend itself against the United States, and it required a superpower friend, and that was the Soviet Union, you know. Today, Taiwan is too weak to defend itself, and it requires a superpower friend, and that's the United States. And in both cases, you know, the Soviet Union back in 1962 wasn't strong enough with conventional forces, Navy, Air Force, for example, or ground forces, to be able to defend Cuba. It was too far away. It was on the edge of the Soviet Union's power projection capabilities. And so they defended Cuba by extended nuclear deterrence. You know, the fact that they were a nuclear power, they relied upon that to try to extend their nuclear umbrella over Cuba. And where Taiwan is concerned today, you know, Taiwan is, now this wasn't the case for many years, you know, because China for decades has been, you know, too weak militarily to project its forces across the straits to invade Taiwan, but that situation has changed. You know, and now Taiwan, relative to Chinese military power, you know, is at the very edge of our ability to project power. You know, and so really, it's our nuclear deterrent that is the chief thing that would protect Taiwan. The situation has gotten so much worse because basically as recently as this summer, we found the Chinese building up their nuclear arsenal. Can you still hear me? Am I?
No, we got you loud and clear.
Make sure we didn't.
You're not talking to yourself.
Right. You know, we've seen the Chinese building first 150, then 200, then 250, then 350, and now up to 400 ICBM silos that we know of, probably for their DS-41 ICBM, which, as we've talked about before in your show, is a 10 warhead ICBM. That can give them 4,000 strategic nuclear weapons that can reach the U.S. homeland, you know, on just that one missile system when it's completed. And they're rushing to completion. It'll be completed in several years. So in just a few years, they'll have 4,000 weapons. That's enormously significant. You know, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had started off about how the Cuban Missile Crisis is the Democrat Party's favorite nuclear crisis. Really the only one they talk about. You know, because Kennedy prevailed and they see that as a big win for the Democrats. But they never talk about the fact that the reason Kennedy prevailed is that he was alarmed about a missile gap. He ran for president, and one of the things he was elected on was that he was going to close the alleged missile gap with the Soviet Union. You know, the Soviets had beat us to building long-range missiles. They had demonstrated an intercontinental capability by orbiting Sputnik. By the way, I remember when I was a little kid visiting my grandmother in Rhode Island, and everybody was standing outside at night, and we could actually see Sputnik, you know, cross the sky overhead. Can you imagine what, for Americans, how terrifying that must have been, you know, that we could actually see the evidence of this artificial satellite, you know, passing over our head?
Yeah.
And we had not orbited satellites. The United States didn't have the capability yet. That was a technological. We were used to being ahead of everybody in technology, and here was this incredible capability. You know, that was maybe 5 years before the Cuban Missile Crisis, all right? And we were engaged in the so-called space race, which was really a race for military superiority also. And we were losing. We were losing that race. So the idea of the Russians being ahead of us in long-range intercontinental missiles was a terrifying prospect. And Kennedy launched a crash program to build ICBMs. You know, first the Atlas, you know, then the Minuteman I, then the Minuteman II. But the Minuteman, by the time we had the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had outproduced the Soviets in ICBMs. We had a 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs. And, of course, we had a vastly superior long-range strategic bomber force. You know, a huge advantage in strategic bombers. And the Democrats always forget that it wasn't Kennedy's courage and leadership, you know, that defeated the Soviet Union during the Cuban Missile Crisis. There were material military reasons he won that. He had prepared for some kind of a crisis by building up our nuclear deterrent. And it was the 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs that made them back off. It was the huge advantage in strategic bombers that made them back off. It was an object lesson at the very beginning of the nuclear arms race that superiority matters a lot. The superiority can make the difference between nuclear war and peace. And it made the difference, you know, because it was a very close call. You know, the Soviets had all their prestige on the line here. Don't forget, Cuba was symbolically important to the Soviet Union because Fidel Castro's revolution appeared to be a victory for the communist system. In fact, it was a victory for the communist system. The people had thrown off the yoke of capitalism and embraced communism in America's own backyard. In America's own backyard. Don't forget, we had American corporations were very heavily invested in Cuba. It was a favorite tourist site and everything. You know, it should have been a shining example for the third world of the virtues of free enterprise. So this was an enormous symbolically important win in the ideological struggle, you know, during the early Cold War.
Let's stop right there for just a second. We'll take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. It is October 10th, 2021. You can find everything about the show at wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but
welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside. There behind the glass stands a real blade of grass. Be careful as you pass. Move along, move along. Come inside, the show's about to start.
I love that song. Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, what a classic group. So, sorry for that brief interruption. Continue on.
Oh, not at all.
Back to Cuba.
Okay, yeah, so back to Cuba. So, you know, everything seemed to be on the line between the superpowers in 1962. You know, they were struggling for the minds of the whole world, free world. You know, Soviet communism claimed it was superior to free enterprise, and they seem to be demonstrating that by Sputnik, by their being ahead of us in the missile race, and now Cuba had gone communist and thrown off and rejected our system. So they had an enormous incentive to protect Cuba and preserve that revolution. We had a very powerful and compelling interest in overthrowing the Cuban government as well. You know, it represented an intrusion on our hemisphere. It was a violation of the Monroe Doctrine, you know, where we had pledged that we were going to keep foreign powers out of our hemisphere. But at the same time, the United States was extremely sensitive to the idea that we were being accused by the communists of being an imperialist system, you know, that we were crushing freedom movements in the third world, that we would not let third world countries have self-determination. And so we couldn't just send the Marines in and overthrow Castro without hurting ourselves and losing the ideological argument with the Soviet Union, or at least that's what our State Department believed. Personally, I think we should have done that, you know, because the strategic situation was far more important than what the rest of the world thought, you know. The rest of the world has always not been too kind to the United States. You know, we're like the only imperial power that has ever existed in history that cares a lot about whether we're loved or not in the rest of the world. You know, and it's okay to be loved, but the first and most important thing is to be feared and to be able to secure, to demonstrate your power to deter adversaries from starting World War III. Being loved doesn't stop World War III. Being feared and demonstrating strength is what stops World War III. The Kennedy administration was persuaded by the CIA to go forward with the Bay of Pigs operation, which failed catastrophically. This was done, and it failed precisely because of this, because of the political correctness of the time, you know, against the United States appearing in the light of an imperialist power by using its military force the way we had so aggressively in World War II. Interestingly, you know, nobody, you didn't hear any voices raised during World War II against the United States being extremely assertive and doing everything that was necessary to win that war against the fascist powers. You know, it's probably only because there are so many people in the left, both in America and in Europe, that the sudden concern, this political correctness about not using all your might to stop the spread of communism, but try to do it without appearing like an imperialist power. This argument was nowhere in evidence during World War II. You know, only came onto the scene with the Cold War when the adversary was from the left, was with the communists. And I suspect it's because there were so many sympathizers to that ideological point of view, even in our own State Department, but also in academia and the press. So we followed their advice, and it was a disaster. You know, the Bay of Pigs blew up on our face. Kennedy almost abolished the CIA because the Bay of Pigs failed, you know, so catastrophically. It also provided the Soviet Union with an excuse to move missiles into Cuba, medium-range ballistic missiles and intermediate-range ballistic missiles. And that was an excuse because their real object 59 years ago, you know, to move those missiles into Cuba was to improve their nuclear posture so they could launch a surprise nuclear attack against the U.S. mainland with very short warning. You know, when you're launching from Cuba, you don't have to go over the North Pole. Have I lost you? Are you still
there? No, we're still here. Okay, no, good. Cuba is so close. I mean, we probably...
90 miles.
Yeah. Not much time to react.
No time to react. And so that was unacceptable to the Kennedy administration, the Pentagon. You know, there were great arguments about what to do about it. You know, the Pentagon wanted to launch a preemptive strike. The decision was made to exercise a quarantine. You know, I remember being on, I was in elementary school, and I remember this thing. I remember the bus driver had a transistor radio, and everybody knew what was going on. Even the school kids knew that we were on the brink of a nuclear war. And the bus driver turned on his transistor radio so we could hear Kennedy's famous speech, you know, about explaining, you know, how we had entered into this confrontation with the Soviet Union over Cuba, and if necessary, we were going to go to nuclear war over it. You know, these were, so the whole world was holding its breath. All eyes were on this, and we have already given the background about how important, you know, the ideological struggle was. Who was the future? Was it the United States and free enterprise and free political systems? Or was it totalitarian communism, you know, with a state, with state-run economies and not a free political system, a system dominated by communism, which claimed to be, you know, the wave of the future.
It was kind of a shock, I think, that Castro turned to the communists after he took power. I think we thought that he was going to have a democratic society, didn't we?
Some people did. Many, I'd say most did not, and realized that he was a committed communist, and the people surrounding him were also communists. There has been a lot of historical disinformation built up by American academia and the left, you know, to try to whitewash Castro's reputation, you know, especially during the Cold War era. Today, and now that the Soviet Union was gone, it's sort of like, it's hard to find anybody who was sympathetic to the communist system and who defended Castro, defended Soviet communism. Even Bernie Sanders would not do that today, even though during the Cold War, he was so in love with the Soviet system that he took his wife on a honeymoon to the USSR.
Right.
You know, it reminds me a lot of the attitudes toward Nazi Germany and France after the defeat of Nazi Germany. Many of the French were collaborators and did think that Nazism was the wave of the future. But you can't find any Frenchman today, who would say, yeah, I was one of those, or my relatives supported the Vichy government, and we really thought that Hitler's Germany was the wave of the future. Suddenly all these voices disappear. But at the time, these people were much in evidence. The point is that this seemed to be the moment. Everybody had been holding their breath. Was there going to finally be a nuclear war to settle the question about the future? Was it going to be communism or the free world? Will it be settled by the force of arms, by nuclear arms? So for the Soviet Union to have backed off, to have agreed to have to back it and to resolve and remove the missiles from Cuba, was an enormous victory for Kennedy and for the free world. I think it astonished the world, because it meant that the Soviets had failed and they were humiliated. They were humiliated. And it did raise questions about, are they really the wave of the future, even among many of their allies and supporters? Because this seemed a huge contradiction. But people forget. I'm sure if this anniversary is celebrated and mentioned on CNN and MSNBC, as it likely will be, because it's one of the, as I say, it's one of the proudest moments with the Democrat Party, one of the great victories that they can point to. It's going to be all about Camelot and John F. Kennedy, and the focus will be on on profiles and courage, as if it was all a question of his personality and character and courage, when the most important factors in the Soviet Union backing off, they don't want to talk about the 5-to-1 advantage in ICBMs that had been built up by the Kennedy administration and before him by the Eisenhower administration. But Kennedy, deserved credit for that, mostly. And the strategic bomber force, they don't like to talk about that because that doesn't fit into any of the Democrat Party's agenda today, where they're all for nuclear disarmament, even in the face of the buildup by China that I was talking about before. Now, there's one last factor I want to talk about in terms of the Cuban Missile Crisis that's kind of relevant, is relevant. America's need to expel communists from Cuba, the ideological and geostrategic need to do that. Obviously, it was the nuclear missiles were an existential threat, and so we had a high priority. We would have had to have gone to war. We couldn't have accepted that, but fortunately, we won that. But aside from that, Cuba didn't really pose an existential threat to us. And so we were able to tolerate Cuba. And even so, we had made an attempt to invade the country and overthrow it. But the situation with Taiwan and China is different. China has a much stronger commitment. You might call it a need if it someday does not take Taiwan, and perhaps someday soon, that constitutes an existential threat to China, at least in the eyes of the government in Beijing. And why is that? Here's where there's some significant differences between the situation between Cuba and Taiwan. the government of Taiwan, many Americans have forgotten, is called the Republic of China. The Republic of China. You know, and that is because they are the descendants of the Chinese nationalists who fought against communism up until 1949. You know, there was a great civil war. Millions of people died in China. A struggle between the nationalists under Chiang Kai-shek and the communists under Mao Zedong. And this, the 1949 was called the Year of Shock for the United States, because most people in the West were convinced that the nationalists were going to win and that we weren't going to have to face a communist China in the future. But the nationalists lost. And what was left of the nationalist forces, they retreated to the island of Taiwan, sort of a Chinese Dunkirk. And Taiwan became their island fortress. And from the perspective of Beijing, you know, the people that Taiwan, they regard as part of their territory. They regard Taiwan as part of communist China's territory, which is illegally occupied by this rebellious, by these rebels, the Republic of China, you know, who they regard as a threat to their existence. Mm-hmm. They fear that someday that the Republic of China might be able to convince the United States and other allies to invade China and take China back, or to foment revolution on the Chinese mainland and overthrow the Chinese communist government. And let's face it, I mean, the Republic of China, you know, they see themselves as a government in exile. If they could foment revolution in China and get China overthrown, they would do it. If
sure.
they could persuade yeah. the United States and our allies to support them, they would definitely go in and invade the mainland and overthrow the Chinese government. We didn't face any kind of same kind of a situation with Cuba. You know, our incentives to invade Cuba were not nearly as great as the incentives China has to invade Taiwan. So that's something we need to keep in mind, you know, why the Taiwan crisis keeps popping up and why it's so important. And we must not underestimate China's commitment to make that succeed.
Now,
China's commitment, China's determination to take Taiwan is more than just ideological, by the way. It has profound geostrategic reasons for doing it. And here's at least two. You know, one of them, you know, is China's trying to build a defensive chain of islands in the South China Sea. And it, as you know, as we've talked about on this show before, they claim ownership of the South China Sea. And Taiwan is one of the most important, it is the most important link in the defensive chain. If you look at a map and you look at where Taiwan is relative to the South China Sea and the size of Taiwan relative to all the other islands, I mean, this is an unsinkable aircraft carrier. You know, we know that China is building islands out in the South China Sea out of nothing. It's building islands so that it can have air bases out in the South China Sea, so it can push its defensive perimeter further and further out into the South China Sea and further out into the Pacific, too, when you consider the radius of modern aircraft. When you look at Taiwan and all the air bases, its military facilities, if a military giant like China were able to get hold of Taiwan, it would make China unassailable by our aircraft carrier groups and our Navy.
Well, it would also
come
put
in there only because Taiwan is independent,
right,
and pose a threat to China from that direction. So that would seal, that would protect them, and it would serve as a base for projecting power against us into the Pacific and against our Pacific allies.
Right.
So it's a really important square on the geopolitical chessboard. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay.
We have to take a really quick break. We'll come back. Hold, everyone, hold that thought. You're listening to We the People. You can join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
Man, I had a dreadful flight. I'm back in the USSR. You don't know how lucky you are.
A couple of selections from Bernie Sanders, the musical. I couldn't help myself.
So we were talking about the potential increase in strength of China if they were to take over Taiwan and their reach. What about Japan?
First, I'd just like to compliment you on the music selections you have during a break, like back in the USSR. Always so appropriate.
I knew you were laughing. I could hear you laughing in my...
For the topic. Before we move on to Japan, I'd just kind of like to complete my thoughts to sort of put the cherry on top, because I wanted to talk about the single most important factor in terms of China's interest. We had concluded that the fact that Taiwan is this incredibly important square on the geopolitical chessboard in terms of China's ability to protect itself and to project power into the Pacific. But the last factor that makes it so important is the symbolic factor, something that I think eclipses Cuba. During the Cold War, during the Cold War crisis we were talking about, because possession of Taiwan basically symbolizes whether or not China controls the future. This at least is what I believe the leadership in Beijing has in their mind and why Taiwan is so important to them. As you know from previous discussions, China is a building empire all over the world with its Belt and Road Initiative, and it has a presence. Not many Americans don't know it, but all over the world, in Europe, in Africa, in South America, in Latin America, China is everywhere, both in terms of economic presence and military presence. And if you are, like the Roman Empire, planning to control the future, looking toward world global domination, it's intolerable that you can't control your own backyard. To them, this is completely unacceptable. And also because they in their perception, the whole world is watching in terms of what can they do about Taiwan. This irritant, this challenge to their own legitimacy. If they can't squash Taiwan, they're never going to have global domination.
Right.
So this is the thing that I think basically makes a war inevitable sooner or later over Taiwan. And it may be a lot sooner than people think. People are thinking that it could come sooner than we have been suspecting already. We're talking about, there have been estimates put out by some members of the Pentagon talking about in 6 years. Others are talking about in 5 years, I think it might be even sooner than that. I wouldn't rule it out as happening even this year. The estimates that are based on 5 or 6 years from now is based on China's sea lift capabilities. The Pentagon's assessment is, they don't have the sea lift capability. They don't have, the Navy is almost there, but they're not quite there to be able to lift enough troops to take over Taiwan. And I think that somebody in the Navy has got to rethink this assumption that invading Taiwan in 2021 is going to be like Operation Tarawa or Operation Iwo Jima in World War II. And that taking an island is all about landing craft and naval capabilities. Have they forgotten that we didn't have to send a single soldier to defeat Japan, the Japanese home islands? We did it from the air. We bombed them into submission. And yes, we used atomic bombs to bomb them into submission. And World War II was ended on the decks of the Missouri without a single American soldier having to have fought and landed on the beaches of the island, home islands of Japan to conquer Japan. Why does the Pentagon and every other analyst in Washington, it seems to me, have forgotten that lesson and thinks that what we ought to, what we need to be doing is counting the number of landing craft and the naval strength that, that China has so that it can breach the Taiwan Strait. They don't need any of that. They can do it all with missiles. And if necessary, I think their commitment to the conquest of Taiwan is so great that they would resort to nuclear missiles. In fact, they have exercised that. They have exercised that. You know, I don't think they'd necessarily, they wouldn't need to obliterate the whole island. You know, I think if they attacked a couple of military centers and wiped them out with tactical nuclear weapons, that escalation would be enough to probably get the Taiwanese to surrender, and it would probably be enough for the United States to seek an exit ramp, because we don't want to have a nuclear war over Taiwan. Well, at least I hope the Biden administration isn't so stupid that they would want to get us into a nuclear war over Taiwan, a nuclear war which we would probably lose. Another factor that didn't exist during the Cuban Missile Crisis and why we would lose this war, is President Kennedy didn't face a coalition of nuclear powers during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He faced the Soviet Union. But we will probably face a coalition of China and Russia and North Korea in a contest over Cuba. As I keep saying on this show and everywhere else, you know, this is the new bloc. They don't always advertise it very publicly because they like strategic surprise. And so they don't hold big conferences. Well, they actually do hold conferences, but they don't make a big deal about it, like in NATO. They even have treaties, but they haven't made a big deal about it. I hope that we ignore the cooperation, the partnership that has grown up, because they would like us to be surprised when push comes to shove, when the war actually comes.
Well, China and Russia have already carried out joint military exercises,
yes,
haven't they?
Major military exercises, yeah, including in Vostok 18, which was one of the, probably the biggest military exercise in world history. And they even had it was a decade ago, there was even a big strategic forces exercise that was jointly held by Russia and China that involved, guess what? A nuclear war over Taiwan.
Oh, boy.
In my article, I quote, it hasn't gotten enough attention in the mainstream press, so I put it out there a couple of times for people to try to listen. There's a quote-unquote unofficial website of China's People's Liberation Army, you know, where they kind of put out stuff that their foreign ministry doesn't want to talk about publicly. I think they intend for us to see it so that we get the message if we're too stupid to get the message. And I don't blame them for thinking that we're too stupid to get the message. You know, our political leaders and military leaders often seem to ignore the obvious. But on this website, I think we may have talked about this in an earlier show, the website responded to a promise by the Prime Minister of in the Defense Ministry, Japan's Defense Ministry, when the United States kind of reminded China that we have an interest in protecting Taiwan. And that's been one of the other dangerous things, you know. The Biden administration has been kind of waffling on whether we would come to Taiwan's defense or not. There's ambiguity there. That's a dangerous thing to do. The ambiguity, well, we'll get into that later. For now, the Biden administration, you know, has spoken up on occasion and indicated to China, to try to tell China to back off, that the differences between Taiwan and China should be resolved peacefully. You know, and not and they shouldn't invade Taiwan. And we've sold arms to Taiwan. We've got to, it's come out recently with that we've had technical people on our troops in Taiwan helping train the Taiwanese to use our weapons, you know. So we have been doing things to demonstrate. Now, Japan tried to be a good ally, and they spoke up, and they said that if the United States comes to the defense of Taiwan against China, Japan will be there. You know, we will help the United States defend Taiwan against China. And in response to that, this unofficial PLA website, you know, basically said, you know, if Japan sends even one soldier or one ship to protect Taiwan, you know, from our reconquest, you know, we will annihilate Japan with repeated nuclear strikes. And Russia will join us in striking Japan with nuclear weapons. And North Korea will join us in striking Japan with nuclear weapons. And we will nuclear bomb Japan until they completely surrender the way they did in World War II. And then Russia and China will occupy Japan and break up, you know, the Japanese home islands. They will be occupied by Chinese and Russian military troops.
Wow.
And one of the things that's interesting is that, you know, we've heard nothing from Russia and North Korea. Their foreign ministries have not come out and denied this. You know, and because it's probably true, almost certainly true, you know, that this actually is a description of the post-war settlement that Russia and China and North Korea have in mind. And I would add, not just for Japan, if Japan were to become involved, I think that it would be naive to assume that they would be more merciful to the United States, who is going to be their chief adversary in Taiwan. I think the outcome that they are describing for Japan is what they would also have in mind for the United States. Our destruction and occupation, if we are foolish enough to push it that far. And how can we be saying this, though? I mean, drew the connection. We should need to go back to the numbers. One always has to come back to the numbers when we're talking about these geostrategic and military threats, because it's the numbers that matter. It's your military capabilities that matter. And China knows that, even if the Biden administration doesn't seem to know it. You know, when China finishes deploying the DF-41 ICBMs in these 400 silos and gets itself a force of 4,000 intercontinental ICBM warheads in just a few years, it's expected to happen. It's not over a decade, but just a few years from now. Because they're deploying these things at such a rapid rate, that will give them a 10-to-1 advantage over the United States in ICBM warheads, a 10-to-1 advantage. Don't forget, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, we had a 5-to-1 advantage over the Soviet Union. And it will give them a nearly 3-to-1 advantage over all of our strategic nuclear weapons, counting all of them on bombers, on submarines, and on ICBMs.
Holy cow.
With the DF-41 alone in those 400 silos, a 3-to-1 advantage in overall nuclear power. That doesn't count all the other nuclear weapons that China
has. Dr. Pry, we're going to come back with you next hour. We're going to hold you hostage in Florida for one more hour and finish this topic, if you can possibly think of finishing this topic. Big topic. Anyway, I found another song from Bernie Sanders' honeymoon reel, so I thought we'd close out the hour with that. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
That dancing girl is making eyes at me. I'm sure she's working for the KGB in this paradise. Ah, cold as ice. In LA.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
Hey, my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer up on Twinview Boulevard and in Shasta Lake. They're right between Oasis and Pine Grove. Just go up and see them if you're looking for a tractor or parts or service or implements. They do it all up there. In fact, they just put up a new big John Deere logo on their sign. You can't miss them. Or give them a call at 226-9226 or catch them on the web at
PapeMachinery.com.
That's right.
I got to do the whole thing.
Yeah, I'm letting you take a little bit of time.
You gave me the whole thing. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
Hey, so I thought I would let people know that today's October 10th, 2021, when we're airing this the first time. Oftentimes we air Dr. Pry's shows at a later date because his information is really, it's usually timely when we do it, but it's kind of timeless in that you get a lot of history and a lot of backstory. So if, in fact, that takes place, you'll know what we're talking about. And there is always a commercial-free recording posted after the show, like later in the afternoon. And you can access that at WeThePeopleRadio.us. I thought I had you on that one.
No, you're
totally not paying attention. But you can get it on the website. It doesn't cost anything to listen to. You can send it to a friend. You can post it online. You can do whatever you want. And for some reason, they don't seem to block us when we put things on Facebook and whatnot. So feel free to put the shows up there and let people get informed, because it seems that the media has no interest in informing anyone of anything, really, these days.
No.
We just go in a circle all the time. And have to listen to things about Hunter Biden's artwork. Maybe we'll get some of that later on today, and how that factors into China, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, and then I did hear that Brian Seltzer now has a new hair care line, so you might want to check that out as well.
Nice. See the little troll, the little bald troll over there on CNN?
Yeah, there you go.
Nice, Bill. Way to throw that in there. So Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is a smart guy. He's done a lot of interesting things, worked for the CIA. He's been the Congressional Strategic Posture Commission and the House Armed Services Committee. He was in, just done a little bit of everything and worked a lot with Russia and the things with the Cold War and nuclear strategy. Also, big player on the EMP issue, the electromagnetic pulse issue. We've done bunches of shows with that, and I should tell you that also on the page today we have a list of his books that are terrific. The Power and the Light is the newest, the most recent, how about that, the most recent one, the Congressional EMPs Commission's War to Save America, and Blackout Wars, EMP Manhattan Project, War Scare, Poseidon, Russia's New Doomsday Machine. So, fun topics. It's probably why they change the topic of his articles all the time when they put him on Newsmax and different places. They always try to give him a kind of a less catchy topic. But I've posted a couple articles for you today that he has: the Taiwan nuclear powder keg, the new Cuban Missile Crisis, and I posted another one before that: how to start an accidental nuclear war. That was from September 17th. So those are both on there for you. All right, Dr. Pry, back to you. On the beach in Florida.
To catch your listeners up completely, I have a new book out.
You do?
Just published on the 1st of September, which is the anniversary of the outbreak of World War II, called Blackout Warfare. And I chose that date for publication, you know, because this describes this revolutionary new way of warfare that I've talked about before on your show, but now I've got a whole book on it. And in fact, it's the first time any such book has been written in the West. You know, I didn't write it alone. It's for the first time we have taken the military doctrine about attacking electric grids and other critical infrastructures using the combination of EMP, both nuclear and non-nuclear, cyber warfare, and special forces sabotage, all of these actors combined, and exploiting severe weather, all of these combined, in a new blitzkrieg in cyberspace, as it were, or in the electronic warfare spectrum, as it were, so that you can fight a war without ever having to have air forces or navies or or soldiers come into confrontation with each other, you know, it can render the traditional instruments of war obsolete and prevail in less than 24 hours, decide the world war in less than 24 hours, like by, in effect, blacking out your adversary. And, you know, for the first time, what we did is we got experts in each of these subject matter areas, nuclear EMP, non-nuclear EMP weapons, special forces sabotage, cyber warfare, weaponizing the weather in the context of, you know, exploiting it for cyber and physical sabotage, and to collaborate in thinking about how the bad guys would do it. You know, they already describe how they would do it in their own military doctrine, but we've never put it all together here in the West and applied it against our own electric grid to see how would this work. And that's basically what the book is about. You know, the first step toward preparing yourself is understanding how the adversary plans to attack you. And this book tries to raise the alarm about that. It tries to explain it in technological detail. So Blackout Warfare, you know, available through Amazon.com.
I'm adding that to the page right now.
Yes, thank you. Maybe I shouldn't have called it that because it sounds so similar to Blackout Wars, which is a different older book. But, you know, I mean, I just think that's the best title because it more accurately describes what they're trying to do. It's a blackout war. They're trying to blackout electric grids. And all of our talk about nuclear weapons and naval forces projected to Taiwan might end up being irrelevant because before any of that happens, I think China and Russia and North Korea would cooperate to launch a blackout war against us first, and they would win that way. They might not have to fire a shot over Taiwan. But look, I've droned on for an hour, more than an hour, and you have patiently, as you always do, given me the floor and listened to me.
We were counting on it.
If you want, I'll be glad to drone on for another hour, not let you guys get a word in edgewise. But
no.
perhaps you'd like to get a word in edgewise, make a comment, or have a bit of a conversation.
One of the things that comes to mind is you talk about a blackout warfare. I'm sure our arsenal also has those types of weapons, doesn't it?
Boy, you know, Americans always assume that. You know, that's because you're a logical, intelligent American, and you think Washington surely thinks logically, intelligently the way I do. And I would be reading the adversary's military doctrine and preparing for this if I were in Washington and responsible so that I would have countervailing capabilities. You know, so that's an excellent point to make. No, we don't. And I don't even believe people will say, well, maybe it's in a black program. You know, I've heard that black program thing used as an argument.
Right.
It's like grasping at straws, you know, falling off a cliff, and you don't want to face that reality, so let's grab this root called the black program, that there's some smart guy embedded, you know, in the system that's thought all this through. No, there aren't. You know, I wish I could say there were. You know, the EMP Commission, when we were in existence, you know, and up until 2017, I mean, we had access to all the classified programs and all of that. And if we had a black program, if we were preparing to offensively attack these guys the way they're preparing to attack us, surely we would have protected our own vulnerable assets by now. We haven't done the basics. We haven't done anything to protect our electric grid or any of the other critical infrastructures. Now, there's a lot of money to do studies. We're always studying the problem. You know, there billions of dollars are allocated to do research and development to study the problem. You know, we don't need to study the problem. The EMP Commission came up with a plan for protecting the grid back in 2008. How many years ago was that now? Long time ago. You know, those commission recommendations should have been implemented. But they haven't been. And, you know, our government, unfortunately, you know, it's I think it would be impossible for us to really have a black program the way we used to in World War II, for example, you know, when we had the Manhattan Project, and we did a pretty good job about concealing it, at least from the American people. We didn't end up concealing it from the Soviets. It turned out they knew all about it because the Manhattan Project was penetrated by their spies. We're such an open society that it's very difficult for us. We may be able to hide small things. I hope we can still hide small things. But big things, like being prepared to fight this new way of war, that's the kind of thing you really can't hide, you know? For example, who's going to fight the war? Theoretically, the people that are best able to fight it would be Cyber Command at NSA, you know? Cyber Command doesn't have any more people working for it than North Korea. Where are the exercises? Why don't we hear reports about retaliatory action against China or North Korea or Russia whenever we get attacked with cyber?
Computer wouldn't shut up.
If the administration ever did something like that, you'd think they'd boast about it, you know, as part of deterrence. But no, I don't think we're prepared to do this. And it's more than just cyber warfare. It's combining cyber warfare with super EMP weapons. We don't have any super EMP weapons. If we were serious about blackout warfare, we would have a super EMP weapon or several of them in our inventory. And we don't. We haven't built a new nuclear weapon in 30 years. Non-nuclear EMP weapons. There we have a little bit of hope. You know, the Air Force has built CHAMP. You know, this is a non-nuclear EMP cruise missile. And it's a good example of a non-nuclear EMP weapon. It can follow power lines. In fact, it's deployed in Japan to go after North Korea preemptively. North Korea plans to strike us or strike the Japanese. We'll send out CHAMP to try to black out everything and interfere with their command and control and fry the electronics in their missiles. So we've got that program. That's something, you know, but CHAMP isn't going to be effective against, you know, China. It doesn't have the range, you know, or Russia. China and Russia are both too big.
Let me ask you this.
I may retract that because you could use a non-nuclear weapon to go after the United States. Of course, we don't have the air defense systems that they do, you know. So my bottom line, that's my long-winded answer to your question. No, I don't think they're going to be deterred because they fear that the U.S. has retaliatory blackout warfare capability.
Right. So
why should they fear them? We have never retaliated for any of the things they've done to us.
Well, that's true. Well, let me ask you the flip side of that. Do you think China and Russia have hardened their electric grids to counter that type of an attack?
Oh, yes. Yes, they have.
Of course they have.
They don't rely on the Internet to run everything the way we do. They are willing to sacrifice efficiency for survivability. And so they use earlier generate. Have I lost you?
No, we're here.
Okay, I'm hearing a beeping on my line. For example, they use older technologies. They're called retro technologies, like electromechanical switches and things like that, that aren't vulnerable to cyber attack or and are much less vulnerable to EMP. Vacuum tube type technology.
Oh, yeah.
Russia is still manufacturing vacuum tubes by the millions. It's the world's leading manufacturer of vacuum tube technology. And that's not because they're backwards. They have technologies that are just as sophisticated as ours. But that's because they use vacuum tube technologies in critical infrastructures and in the military, you know, in order to harden them against nuclear EMP effects and against cyber effects.
Right.
So, yeah, they have... whenever they build a critical infrastructure, the first thing they think about is how to protect it.
Right.
Because they are totalitarian military dictatorships, and security is always at the top of their mind. That seems to be the last thing we think about.
Yeah.
Because we're an optimistic, free, and open society, and the good life, and how can we do things the least expensively, you know, is always our highest priority.
Sure.
The last thing we seem to think about is security.
Well, we don't seem to, I mean, let's face it, you're looking at the multi-trillion dollar sort of Damocles hanging over our heads, and there's nothing in that that's useful or prudent or would solve any of these problems. It's all just a bunch of weirdo feel-good nonsense. That's my legislative assessment.
All right. We'll take a break.
Quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
When the lights go out and you throw yourself about in the dark, that's where you learn to see. They all bought Cadillacs and left there long ago. They held a concert out in Brooklyn to watch the island bridges blow. They turned our power down and drove us underground.
See, that song seems pretty realistic. It's all going to be bad. It's all going to be bad. And then all of a sudden, we all go right on with the show. There you go.
Yep.
All of a sudden, there's
show goes
this
on.
Big optimistic ending. It's all just going to be magically saved.
Just cover your head when you get under the desk and don't look
yep.
at the light. And
yeah, if you,
you'll be fine.
If you ever, you know, switch your book and, you know, make it sort of a fantasy. How about that? Let's turn it into a just happy ending. There you go. You can
a musical.
Billy Joel, the power musical. It's true, though. You know, Americans have a hard time envisioning that. I mean, the bad news is the bad news, despite the events of the last year and a half, or 2 years, actually.
Yeah, it's a concept. It's our strategic culture. You know, our strategic culture, I would define it as dysfunctionally optimistic.
Yeah.
You know, our history is so different from that of the nations in Eurasia. You know, we've been protected by the Atlantic and Pacific from the wars of Eurasia, unless we've decided to get involved in them. And then even when we do get involved in them, we've been still protected by the Atlantic and Pacific pretty much, so that our cities are not bombed and we don't suffer millions of deaths, you know, the way they do in Eurasia. You know, we mourn, you know, something like the casualties, the deaths we suffered in World War II, for example, were modest compared to, for example, the Soviet Union, Germany, the other countries that were participants. We actually, the bloodiest war we fought was against ourselves, the American Civil War, 750,000 dead. You know, long time ago. And so this extremely benign, and it's just in the nature, I think, of free systems, free political systems, free enterprise systems.
Well, and,
to be optimistic, to
yeah,
look on the bright side.
Yeah, but it's so easy for us to forget our history and come up with these cracker box ideas of how it's really going to go down when it's pretty clear how it's going to work if we're not prepared.
Right. You know, if Nazi Germany had had the technologies today and Imperial Japan had the technologies that are available today, they would have won, you know. The totalitarians are getting another shot at it, and they have those technologies. This is a bigger threat, too, the combination of Russia, China, North Korea, Iran, international terrorism. They're all on the same side. They're all working together as strategic partners. This is a bigger, stronger combination than the free world has ever faced in its history, bigger than the one we faced in the Cold War, with weapons that are more formidable, far more formidable, and not just the nuclear weapons. The ones that might be most decisive are the ones described in my book, Blackout Warfare, you know, where we might not, they might be able to win. I mean, the good news is that it's that under these conditions, millions of Americans don't have to die, you know, as they would in a nuclear war. Although you could lose up to 90% of the population through starvation, disease, and societal collapse.
Sure.
If we do the wrong thing and we don't protect ourselves. But, you know, I think one of the things the bad guys are counting on is that, so China takes Taiwan under conditions where they've blacked us out. All right. And then what does the president do? Does he go into a losing war to try to save Taiwan, or does he use the limited resources that are still available to us that are going to be mostly in the military to try to turn the lights back on in America? You know, if he follows the Constitution and thinks of what the interests of American people are, he'll try to save their lives. And so, you know, it's possible that, that we'd end up not getting into a nuclear war and not having those massive casualties. But world order would change, you know. We would no longer be in charge. The bad guys would be in charge of the world. And we might end up with an outcome like the one that was described in that unofficial PLA website, where they say, okay, we're not going to destroy you, you know, but you need to start following certain rules under administration as weak as the Biden administration. I wouldn't be surprised in the aftermath of a blackout war if he agreed to the occupation of the United States. At least political commissars who would, make sure that Americans are not armed, and it would become a totalitarian, tyrannical system like their own. You know, it's our freedom that they fear most, our free system that they fear most. And if that can be eliminated, it could be okay for the nation to continue to exist, possibly, as long as it was under their thumb.
Yeah, and
of course,
I think
the problem with the
projection that our government is giving the rest of the world right now is not good, and I think that's got to be a factor when they decide their next move. I mean, they look at what's happening over here with our leadership, and this might be a great time to make the move. Who knows?
Right. I mean, who would be afraid of General Miley? You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
Exactly.
Wow. Not only have you got Biden, but you've got General Mark A. Miley in charge of the Pentagon.
Mm-hmm.
And the Secretary of State, the whole team that he's got in charge are people that, you know, handpicked to lose World War III. You know,
well,
these people are not General Patton. You know, they are not Eisenhower. They are losers.
Mm-hmm.
And that can be seen. They can't even manage Afghanistan. Unbelievable.
Well, they managed
and
it.
And these are the guys at the top. I mean, this is supposed to be our best and brightest and our most experienced, and we're not giving a good projection to the world, even as far as protecting our allies. I'm sure they're a little bit concerned.
And as an intelligence officer on the other side, if I were looking at it, to say, well, how far – the fish rots from the head down.
Mm-hmm.
How far down has the rot gone? You know, we actually have some data on that. You know, I can't remember his name, this lieutenant colonel, right, who decided to Shall go to jail. Okay? So you've got to go from General Miley all the way down to Lieutenant Colonel Scheller to find where the rot has not reached, down to the Lieutenant Colonel level. In between, everybody seems to be rotten. That's really scary. You know, so this idea that China's going to attack in Taiwan in 5 or 6 years is, I think, optimistic. You know, it could happen tomorrow. It really could happen tomorrow. They don't need a Navy to do it, you know, the Navy airlift to do it. You know, they've got the means at hand to do it now.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the only thing that may be deterring, you know, holding off World War III is that America hasn't hit rock bottom yet. You know, this nuclear posture review is coming up. That's another thing I talked about in the article. You know, it just isn't on the table anywhere for us to be competing, doing what Kennedy did, and competing with Russia and China. Well, he wasn't competing with China then, but competing with our adversaries to not allow them to get strategic nuclear superiority. You know, that's not in the plans. In fact, it's just the opposite. You know, Biden has called for this new nuclear posture review in January. And Democrats, a lot of Democrat leaders, as we've talked about on your show earlier, they want to ban ICBMs. They want to ban U.S. ICBMs. They want to ban U.S. nuclear bombers. They want to cut the planned ballistic missile submarine force in half to 6 boats so that all whole nuclear deterrence will depend on 6 boats. You know, even while Russia and China and North Korea are building, you know, this is suicidal. It's completely oblivious to the reality of the world, to the facts that are in front of us on the world in terms of what's happening. Clearly, our adversaries see that there is great military value in nuclear weapons, and that minimum deterrence is not all you need or all you desire, because they're building up these huge numbers of nuclear weapons. And we should have known that from our own history, the Cuban Missile Crisis that we talked about. You know, the virtue, one of the greatest things, that one of the things that makes the nuclear weapons the most powerful piece on the chessboard is the fact that it enables you to win without war. You know, Kennedy won the Cuban Missile Crisis without war because he has strategic superiority. Ronald Reagan won the Cold War without war because he had at least parity. He had built up the strategic parity with the Soviet Union. You know, we've got strategic inferiority, and yet we are running around. The Biden administration seems to think that it's still, you know, that we still have a big advantage or something, or that being outgunned in the nuclear firepower indices, all of them, doesn't matter, that it won't make any difference. It's just totally irrational and suicidal.
Yeah, it does make a difference.
It does make a difference. And this nuclear posture review, I mean, I say it in the article, I've said it in other articles, I'm going to keep saying it, this nuclear posture review should be going in the opposite direction. The choices should not be a best case outcome in the nuclear posture review right now is, well, let's just keep plodding along with the current modernization program that we inherited from Barack Obama and that he never delivered on. You know, it took Trump to deliver on Obama's modernization program. You know, it's not the Trump modernization program, except in that Trump funded it and got it going. But it's a very slow, you know, it's going to take, most of the stuff isn't going to be in our, and come online until for another decade. And the capabilities of the systems that we're deploying are not improved. It'll be the same kind of a deterrent that we've always had, since Ronald Reagan anyway, using technologies, updated versions of technologies that are date to the Reagan era and before. That's not the world we're in. We're in a different century, you know, of advanced nuclear weapons, new kinds of nuclear weapons, nuclear delivery system designs, weapons that combine artificial intelligence with special effects like EMP and super EMP. You know, this is what we're up against with the other side. You know, so the current best case plan is inadequate to the challenge of the future. You know, the worst case, so that's the best outcome we can hope for from the NPR. you know, is an inadequate triad, and a triad that is inadequate. The thing I'm most afraid of is that the radical anti-nuclear activists who have come to power in the Biden administration are going to be listened to, and we won't even have a triad anymore. They'll get rid of the ICBMs, they'll get rid of the bombers, and they'll cut the ballistic missile submarine force in half, and we'll have a great experiment, you know, to see if we can actually reduce to a minimum deterrent posture and not get nuked. You know, that has never been tried before. You know, if we surrender, maybe we won't get nuked. Okay, but the whole point is that you don't want to have to be in a position to lose and surrender and let the other guy win without war.
Right.
The way the United States won Cuba, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and the way the United States won the Cold War without war. We're being put in a position where that's going to happen to us. And that means changing the world order. I mean, you know, it means that, that the totalitarians will dominate the world. And that's going to have very significant implications for us, including in the homeland, not just for our foreign relations and all the rest. We're going to have to start dancing to their tune. That's what it means to be an inferior power. And, you know, we're afraid about tyranny coming from the inside, and we should be. We should be afraid from about tyranny at home because our Constitution is being violated in so many ways. But it will surely come if we are dominated by totalitarian, tyrannical powers. You know, can you imagine an America that's under the thumb of Putin and Xi and Kim Jong-un and what they will,
yeah,
the kinds of things they will demand of us?
Yeah, that's not going to work out good for anybody, at least in the West. So let's take one last break. And
then we'll roll to the top of the hour with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People, and you can find this show online all the time, free of charge to listen to, send to a friend at
wethepeopleradio.us.
Choice than to deport you.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me. When the road looks rough ahead and you're miles and miles from your nice warm bed, you just remember what your old past said. Boy, you got a friend in me. Yeah, you.
Okay, that's not James Taylor.
That's close.
Super not James Taylor. Epic fail. I'm all like, Travis, play James Taylor. You got a friend. We'll do a little diplomatic mission.
It sounded like Randy Newman.
I'm like, what is going on? You get a demerit on that one. We were going for the funny. Little James Taylor, you've got a friend. You know, Bill thought that would be, you know, because harkening back to the Obama administration.
Well, John Kerry and James Taylor went over on a diplomatic mission. And,
secret mission,
and
yeah.
Got everybody on our side.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
and when
what
that,
we have.
And then we had to play a little hardball, and we sent Dennis Rodman over to South Korea, and he got the little rocket man straightened out. So, you know, we've got some secret weapons, Dr. Pry.
Well, you know, I keep thinking about that song, What Do We Do About That?
Yeah.
What do we do about them? You keep playing that song.
Exactly.
You know, and I don't know what to do about them. Maybe we should go have a big steak at the Black Bear Diner. you know, I hope they serve alcohol at the Black Bear,
yeah,
Bear Diner.
We're going to need it.
I'm getting ready to tie one on.
Yeah, don't get a table next to the window because it'll, you know.
He's going to tie one on. No pun intended. Sorry, just couldn't let that
right.
go. it's just so crazy. I mean, it's just crazy. How do they think this is going to turn out?
You know, I I'm not sure how the how our side thinks it's going to turn out. God knows what they're thinking. There were rumors at one point that, you know, the administration is so irrational that that they were going to send Kerry to negotiate with China.
Dear God,
getting them to be more serious about the climate change.
Oh, God. Yeah, because that's what they're concerned about.
Yeah, that they would cut a deal with the Chinese over Taiwanese independence and give up Taiwan to get China to play ball on climate change. That's how out of the fantasy world they're living in. Can you imagine? I mean, there would be an instant credibility loss. America's credibility is already in the garbage can. But that would definitely tie it up. It would prove that we are completely unreliable as a lot. Completely unreliable, and nobody could trust us. Practically don't trust us now.
Well, it makes us look delusional. I mean, to look at what's going on in the world today and then say, oh, wow, you know, we've got to really get a handle on this climate change thing. It's kind of like, are you not paying attention?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right. They are not paying attention. They aren't. Unbelievable. It's just, you know, there's the old saying, I've said it before about, you know, God looks after fools, little children, and the United States of America, you know. We need that to be true more than ever. We need that to be true more than ever.
Yeah. So who in there is, do we have any serious players that you've been involved in this a long time? Have we purged out all the serious players from your estimation?
As far as I can tell, you know, I mean, some of the most serious players are co-authors on my new book. For example, one of the deepest thinkers, guy I admire, and one of the most, has been the most influential, but he's on the outs now, is Admiral Studeman, Bob Studeman. You know, he was, I think, one of the few people who's ever lived who was the director of NSA, director of CIA, and the director of Navy intelligence, and is a very creative thinker, a very deep thinker. You know, he participated in my book Blackout Warfare because he agrees with me that this is, you know, a new revolutionary, the greatest revolution military force in history. So I wish he were back in power. Jim Woolsey, another contributor to the book. Dr. William Graham, who. Pardon?
Oh, there you are. There you go.
Yes. I'll stop walking around. You know, all the best and brightest people tend to be from the great generation. You know, the people that won the Cold War. And they're still with us. But they're in retirement or semi-retirement or they're out of power. There are younger people who are really good, but they're also out of power. And, you know, there are a few people at lower levels, you know, that are part of the permanent bureaucracy and places like the Department of Homeland Security Stratcom, and the Department of Defense. You know, I'd say the Admiral Charles Richard, he's the current chairman of Stratcom. Smart guy, a realist, you know. He sees what's coming. So he's in power. We've got that at least. Even Frank Kendall, who is Biden's Secretary of the Air Force, is a competent person who understands the threat. You know, just recently talked about the threat that I was talking about the first strike from China, you know, that China, you know, is not what we used to think about no first use and having very few limited, you know, he's seeing the writing on the wall. You know, unfortunately, you know, I can't think of a single person in the White House or on the NSC staff anymore. But there are still, you know, as usual, some good people in the Pentagon. Unfortunately, as we were just talking about before, all of these guys are subordinate to Mark Milley, the Secretary of Defense. And they can be fired or asked to resign by Biden or them, you know, at any time. So they show courage. While they haven't criticized the Afghanistan thing, kind of out of their bailiwick when you're STRATCOM, they are speaking truth to power when it comes to the nuclear threats from Russia and China and North Korea. So that we've got that going for us, at least.
Yeah.
But they need the resources. It's not enough for them to see the writing on the wall. They need the resources, you know. They need new ICBMs. They need blackout warfare capabilities. You know, and they're not getting that. All this money we're printing up, trillions of dollars, and, you know, it's going to climate change type issues. The electric grid is being hardened. Nothing's being hardened against cyber or EMP threats, you know. You know, the troops are being, we're losing. Not enough attention is being paid to this critical race theory brainwashing that's going on in the military. And this COVID vaccination requirement so that if you're a member of the military, you know, you can only get an exemption on religious grounds. You know, and have to prove it. You have to prove that you're a conscientious dissenter from, you know, to me, this sounds like an attempt to impose political correctness in the military. They want to root out the mm-hmm. conservatives in the military and have anybody who will submit to this, okay, and say, yeah, I'm going to let you inject something into my body, violate, and I will salute and obey that order. This is the kind of army you're trying to build, you know, that's designed. It's a totalitarian army, you know. People who have conscientious objections and have the courage to speak up against things that they think are wrong in the military is exactly the kind of soldier we want. We want soldiers of freedom. We want soldiers of conscience. We don't want mindless automatons who will obey any order, no matter how ridiculous. You know, armies like that are used to kill 6 million Jews. You know, armies like that are used to kill 10 million Ukrainians during the Soviet Holodomor. You know, we don't want that kind of army. But the Biden administration apparently wants that kind of army. Why? You know?
Yeah.
Is it because they don't want to get the Marines to the point where they're going to be willing to shoot down elderly Trump voters? I mean, if we believe the rhetoric that we're being told, you know, people like myself, and like a lot of the listeners to the show are considered potential domestic violent extremists.
Oh,
you
yeah.
know, this is a...
Well, and then this, you know, it's interesting. A lot of times the folks that are not real players in, like I know when Obama came in, the Tea Party was filled with people for the most part, and there's no all and there is no never, so I get that. But the bulk of the people were not parents of school-age kids. They were grandparents. And the parents were busy. They had, you know, kids in school. They had a lot going on. It's interesting that this brewing revolution has swept in the parents, and especially with this latest thing, you know, that they want the FBI to go, you know, watch parents at school board meetings.
Yeah.
Parents are like, that's it. Bridge too far. And now you're going to give my, you know, try to give my kid a shot against, you know, against my wishes. And it's interesting. They're mobilizing a totally different pushback. And the folks that were already mad from 2009 are still there. So it's like they're pretty much bringing in
everybody. They're not addressing real threats. I mean, there are real threats happening, foreign and domestic. I mean, crying out loud, look at our border. They aren't addressing that. And there's foreign threats that they're not addressing, but they're taking time to come up with, you know, an environmental league or whatever they are, hire a bunch of people to enforce environmental
law. They want
the
climate
soldiers.
The climate core. That's
climate
it.
Core.
Climate
there
core.
Yeah, now that's important.
We tried to get the member of Congress here in this district tried to get some of the climate core money moved to forest management, so maybe we didn't have to burn down another, you know, a couple million acres next year. And no, can't let go of any of that money. We need the climate core. So we're going to have, like, I don't know, 18-year-olds out there checking the blanket on your hot water heater or whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's important. Yes. I mean,
I've gone crazy.
Yeah. So I don't know. There's a lot of crazy stuff happening right now. And my biggest concern is the rest of the world is watching and they're seeing the crazy stances we're taking on topics that really aren't that pressing when there's all these other things that in any other country, they wouldn't let their borders be overrun. You know, they wouldn't, they would address these threats, the real threats, and not these imaginary ones.
Yeah, what do you think they think about when they see what's going on our border?
Our allies or our adversaries?
Yeah. Both. I think our adversaries are kind of thinking this is kind of a great deal for them.
It's going to be a great door in right here.
Yeah, I think our adversaries, and this is true both for the United States and for our West European NATO allies, because the West European NATO allies, like Germany, you know, France, they have not been observing border security either. And have been suffering tremendously, increasing in crime and overburdening of social services and the like. And, I think it shows to them that nationalism is dead in these countries and that they are easier prey than they have ever been because they don't even respect their own borders. And
right.
They're not willing to defend their own borders from people who don't even have arms. So
yeah.
why should they defend their borders from a real army when there's a real price to be paid for opposing that army? You die by opposing that army. You know, I think that's what our adversaries think, and they think of that of the United States too. That there's this faction in the United States, a faction in charge, that doesn't believe in nationalism anymore. That thinks nationalism is a dirty word, and that the commitment to defend the United States is daily evident, is evidently not there on a daily basis, every day, that the border is open. It shows we don't care about our sovereignty. We don't care about our national existence. Because we're in the process of destroying it by this suicidal
right.
policy.
And that's huge. I mean, that should not be taken lightly. When you dissolve our borders... I think that's just the beginning.
Well,
of the
especially
end.
Since we're paying the contractors who were supposed to be building the wall to just do nothing while all the materials sit there. I'm not sure how many people know that. We have got to run away. Dr. Peter Pry has been here with us again. Our stalwart educational tool finally got James Taylor queued up for some national security stuff here, so we can go out thinking about.
Yeah, Dr. Pry, thanks for coming on this weekend. Enjoy the rest of your day out there on the beach.
Thank you so much for having me. Always therapeutic. Yeah.
Well, happy to be here. All right.
Okay. Thanks again.
When you're down and troubled and you need a helping hand, and nothing, nothing is going right, close your eyes and think of me, and soon I will be there to brighten even your darkest night. You just call up my name, and you know. know wherever I am, I'll come running. Oh yeah, baby, see you again. Winter, spring, summer, or fall, all you got to do is call, and I'll be there. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've got a friend.